You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show, which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today is Dr. Chuck Bomer. Dr. Bomer is a professor in the political science department, and I just want to let you know that this show was taped on Tuesday, November 20th, and the reason I'm saying that is because, of course, it's Saturday today when it's airing, and things may have changed. But we're here to talk about what's going on in Israel and Israeli conflict. Of course, there's been a lot of things going on in the Middle East for years, and Dr. Bomer is expert in international relations, and that is some of the classes that he teaches here on campus, and we're very fortunate to have him come down here. Thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, as far as I mentioned, that we're going to talk about the Israeli conflict, what makes this different, Chuck, as far as what's happened before? Because for a long time, we were worried and Iran was saying that they were going to wipe Israel off the face of the earth, stuff like that. But did we expect this, or did you as a political scientist expect something like this to happen this soon?
Well, the current conflict in the area of Gaza is an extension of what has actually been happening for a few decades. It's, you know, rooted in the old intifadas, and you have increasingly difficult conditions for the Palestinians. Over the past 10 years, Israel has greatly increased measures to improve its security, such as building the border wall, significant checkpoints, while also expanding settlements, particularly in the West Bank. And so Gaza is part of Israeli proper, but has autonomy and is basically a sealed-off area. And to just give you some perspective, the size of Gaza would be about twice the size of El Paso County, but with a population that would be probably about four or five times larger. And so it's an extremely densely populated area, which is rather important when it consider the possibility for civilian casualties for any kind of military action whatsoever, whether it be airstrikes or any kind of potential ground war. And so this area of Gaza is a area that is highly dependent and cut off from most of the rest of the world, receives its food through Israel, which is, of course, checked and monitored. Weapons are smuggled in most often from the Egyptian border, and there's even a blockade off the coast. And so it's rather difficult to get in or out of Gaza, and it's highly monitored by the Israelis. And so the conditions there have been rather poor, whether it's sanitation, poverty, these types of issues. And so the living conditions are clearly one sort of grievance that the Palestinians have living in that area, which is markedly worse than even areas of the West Bank.
So it was interesting what you told me what Gaza is. And when you just explained that it would be outside of El Paso County with that many people, it's incredible to imagine that many people in an area like that. You said that in a way it could be seen as a sort of a prison type because they can't leave, they can't go anywhere, they have to stay in that area.
It's highly monitored and guarded and regulated and blockaded by the Israeli military. And so that's so that weapons don't easily get into Gaza, but clearly they do. And so the probably most poorest area is the border. And so geographically, Gaza is on the Mediterranean Sea, the southwest part corner of Israel that borders the Sinai Peninsula and Egypt. And so that border there is the most porous, and then that's obviously where most of the weapons would be smuggled in.
We were discussing that we needed to explain about Gaza, and you said that you also would like to explain a little bit about West Bank, because people hear it all the time, Gaza, West Bank, Hamas, etc., but they may not understand fully or in detail exactly what it is.
Areas of the West Bank were not part, or at least designed to be part, of Israeli proper. And through the expansion of wars starting in 1948, and then especially in the 1967 Six-Day War, Israel's expanded its territory. And so the West Bank particularly was an area that was multi-ethnic. You'd find Maronite Christians, you would find Jews, you would find Islamic Palestinians living all in that area, depending on which part of the West Bank and which neighborhoods. And so Jerusalem is a holy city for three major religions. In that case, it was designed not to be part of Israeli proper, but Israel's expanded its territory. And to this day, there have been for the last 10 years or more these expansion of Israeli Jewish settlements into areas of the West Bank. And what that has often done has further pushed a lot of the Islamic Arab communities farther away from the parts of the West Bank into narrower and narrower areas. And so these settlements are one big source of grievance that the Palestinians have. But then Gaza has its own issues related to particularly the living conditions, their ability to be represented by some authority that would actually be sovereign as a country, a nation state. And so that type of autonomy has only gone so far. There's the Palestinian Authority, which is supposed to, at least on paper, be the governing body for the Palestinian territories. But it's really restricted to matters like education and garbage pickup. And so it really has little authority or any kind of strong police force to stop those that are prone to attack Israel. And in Gaza, Hamas is really the sort of de facto government, and they have the weapons, and they're considered a terrorist group by Israel, and Israel will not necessarily negotiate with them. Although there's sometimes common agreement between Hamas and Israel, even about more radical al-Qaeda-type elements that have a more broader mission, where Hamas's mission, in theory, is to eliminate Israel as a state. But its main focus is particularly Israel, and so it doesn't necessarily link up well to broader movements such as al-Qaeda. Its mission is really its grievance against Israel.
Tell us why, Chuck, is there so much hatred in the Middle East towards Israel? And where they're located, I mean, it seems like you would be living in a neighborhood and all your neighbors around you didn't like you.
This has been, of course, due to the rise of the Israeli state, because there are many parts of the Middle East that Jews have lived for centuries until maybe the last 10, 20 years, even in places like Syria, which had been fighting wars with Israel as long as the Jews were not politicized and very visible. Until the last 10 years or so, they actually lived there without much uncomfort. And that was true of a few other places in the Middle East. But this has become more a polarizing issue as Israel's become particularly stronger and the Palestinians feel that they suffer more. And so with the expansion of Israel, this led to, of course, the displacement of many Arabs and people who will not conform to Israeli state, because there are many Arabs that are Israeli citizens who are basically not seen as threats to the state, that agree with the existence of Israel and don't challenge it. So it's not the case that even all citizens of Israel are Jewish. That is not the case at all. But those that particularly feel displaced and have a more militant outlook, then they have been mostly restricted to living in places like Gaza or the West Bank, and that's where their neighborhoods and settlements have been. And so what this has felt like is that the Jews have been particularly hated, because with the expansion of the Jewish population, which there were some that were pushing for the Israeli state, of course, and some were even using their own terrorist tactics at the time, that was a state that was in many ways kind of born in through a baptism of fire. In a lot of ways, it was born through conflict, and the expansion of Israel has meant the displacement of many Arabs who then have a grievance in their mind. And so it's a very partisan issue, depending on which way you stand, whether Arabs were displaced or whether they voluntarily fled in these types of ways. But that's the heart of it. And so they've been moved basically to smaller and smaller areas, including Gaza, and that's why the population density is so particularly high in that strip. And so that's seen as, in some views, almost an ethnic cleansing, as areas become more Jewish, more Israeli, and the Arabs are pushed into smaller and smaller areas of the remaining territory. Now, the solution would be a two-state solution, but that's a very difficult proposition, given the fact that the Palestinians would have to acknowledge the existence and right of Israel to exist. And so that's something that is typically run particularly against Hamas's philosophy and also the older Palestinian Liberation Organization until it had moderated to some degree. And so until there is some return of some of that territory that the Arabs once possessed leading to something that would be much more balanced. Most Palestinians would still have some issue with the existence of Israel and still support some militant action. Whether or not an individual goes out and actually fights Israel is another matter. But it's seen as a just cause from their point of view. And of course, this same is acknowledged by many Arab countries, and most of the countries in the world will at least have some sympathy, if not take more sides with the Palestinians than the Israelis.
And what role does this put us in, us as the United States? Because there have been talks, news stories in the past about President Obama not really seeing eye to eye with Netanyahu. And for years, the United States has supported Israel and continues to. What is this going to do as far as the future? And is this something going to be high on the president's agenda as he begins his second term?
Well, it's a rather fascinating issue for a few reasons. Particularly, the future of Israel is somewhat uncertain depending on what kind of perspective you take. The Israelis have gained a lot of security by the measures that they've taken, but it's made for much more difficult living conditions for the Palestinians. And at the same time, this has made Israel generally more unpopular with many European countries that were originally supportive of the founding of the Israeli state. And in some American circles as well, the United States would typically be much more in favor of the Israeli position than the Palestinian position for both cultural reasons, security reasons, and part of the traditional approach of to the informal alliance that the United States has had with Israel. But with that said, there are growing populations in the United States, such as the Muslim community, that distinctly are now becoming in size similar to the Jewish community. And so this is some potential factor in U.S.-Israeli relations, especially if there eventually becomes more balance between Muslims and Jews and their views of Israel. And with that said, of course, not all Jews in the United States support Israelis' actions, especially in the last 10 years, because of the seemingly draconian nature to them, although they've worked for Israel. The amount of terrorists that get through, the amount of bombings has been greatly reduced. And that's why these rockets shot out of Gaza are one of the few means that the Palestinians actually have, Hamas in particular, of actually striking at Israel in this day and age. And so the relationship between Netanyahu and Obama has often appeared somewhat strained. But with that said, it was very clear that Israel has delayed a lot of these actions in basically having some sensitivity to the American elections, knowing that they wouldn't get potentially less support from an Obama administration if reelected, if they had actually done something to make it more difficult for Obama to get elected. But that would even also be something that would have irritated many Americans and the government and also citizens if Israel acted in such a rogue fashion with disregard to its main benefactor that it had no sympathy or sensitivity whatsoever to the American political context. So now that the American elections are over, this is an action that was clearly timed with that factor in consideration, along with other strategies. But there are also some other issues. As I mentioned, there are multiple reasons to think about Israel's future that are quite interesting, especially demographic factors. The Palestinian population is growing at a much higher rate than the Israeli population. And this is particularly true depending on which denomination or sect of Jewish society you're talking about religiously. The more reformed, moderate, or even liberal Jews tend to have a birth rate that is similar to Western Europe and other countries that are highly developed in the sense that they have fewer babies. But the much more Orthodox or Hasidic factions of Israeli society have a much higher birth rate. And so some of these different sects, depending on which you talk about, have a much more conservative, less compromising view of the Palestinians. And so on the Israeli side, you have the population shifting to some degree to those that are much more militant and pro-Israeli, and to the degree that the entire area of the territory they see as the broader Israeli state, and that this would make a two-state solution impossible. In particular, there are also some Israelis that like the Hasidic community that do not serve in the military. So while some of these pushed Israeli politics to the right, they also are not necessarily going to be the ones who do some of the fighting, depending on which segment of society you're talking about. So that has actually led to a greater polarization in Israeli politics about the Palestinian question, but a whole host of other issues, even just taxation issues, social services. So it's a rather fascinating type of a demographic change that's been going on in Israel these days. Now, of course, with the Palestinians, you also find that there's a range of views, some that are members of Hamas or very sympathetic or supportive of Hamas's mission, whereas others would like to see compromise, such as the Palestinian Authority. And so those moderate views, of course, are often undermined. And so any kind of conflict like you see in Gaza right now tends to actually give more credence or support to those that are less compromising, whether it's Netanyahu's government and the conservatives or Hamas on the other hand. So any attempt to form compromise is often easily torpedoed by those that can instigate some kind of attack by the other in this sense. And so Hamas's provocative or threatening actions to Israel, as they're seen as terrorist acts, of course, lend credence to the less compromising Israeli position. Israel's retaliation, of course, then is often evidence that Israel is untrustworthy, unwilling to compromise, and thus is inhumane in their treatment, especially when you start to show civilian casualties in places like Gaza, which any kind of military action is going to easily produce because of the huge population density. So those factors are rather important and drive this. And on the one hand, there is room for compromise, but these political coalitions on both sides make it a rather difficult road to navigate. And so that's why this chapter seems in some ways like more of the same compared to previous instances or episodes of Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but there are changes going along the way, such as these demographic changes on both sides. In many ways, the Palestinian condition is much worse than it's been in the past, and they're getting to a point where they have little to lose by violence, especially if it doesn't look like there's going to be a two-state solution that's viable in the near future. And of course, the more that Israel feels threatened by the Palestinians, and particularly in Gaza, the more that they are forced to take these types of military measures that just kind of reinforce and pour fuel on this fire.
What about other countries like Iran, who has already verbally threatened Israel, Korea, Russia, other countries like that? Are they going to see this as an opportunity to perhaps jump in?
Some countries, of course, are opportunistic with their rhetoric, but the ones that are most directly affected by this are Egypt, Jordan, Turkey, Lebanon, Iraq, of course, because they're between Iran and Israel, and a few other countries in the neighborhood that have something to potentially lose or even gain in a few circumstances if a broader war actually started. The good news is that most countries in the region do not necessarily want to fight Israel directly, because either it's just no longer in their military, political, or economic interests, or they, even if they had some sense that they would like to fight Israel, that they're likely to lose because of the basic experience of the past wars. And so there's not been a conventional war against Israel since 1982, and even that one was in Lebanon, which was not quite the same type of Israeli wars I saw in the Yom Kippur War, the Six-Day War in 1973 and 1967, or the 56 War. And so those wars basically showed that Israel was militarily superior to its neighbors as long as it wasn't caught unprepared, like it was in the Yom Kippur War in 1973, which it almost lost. So given that, the will for the Arab countries to actually get into a war with Israel has been much lower in the last 20 to 25 years than it had been before. And most countries would not necessarily want to risk actually losing a war, even if they found that there was some political reason to do so. Egypt is interesting in the sense that it's a volatile situation and has had generally decent or good relations because of its peace treaty with Israel. But it's with its political changes, it becomes more uncertain. So Egypt is sort of the wild card. Syria has been Israel's most longstanding enemy because of the Golan Heights, which Israel occupied from Syria in 1967. And until last week or so, there had not been a shot fired from those Golan Heights against Syria, but that's Syria's main grievance. But Syria is actually involved in its own civil war, so that makes it rather difficult for Syria to actually have much direct relevance as far as actually fighting Israel directly. That is the worst timing in the world for them. Lebanon with Hezbollah is another factor. Hezbollah has become even more militant and has not gone away as Israel had withdrawn its troops from southern Lebanon. So Hezbollah is another factor that nobody's had been talking about, but at least in a broader war, Hezbollah would seem to have some factor. Iran is interesting in the sense that their nuclear program may make it more the case that Israel attacks them than the other way around. And so one of the speculations offered in the last few days was that Israel has actually been testing its air defense systems, this dome that it's actually produced to protect itself from incoming missiles, by attacking Gaza in order to get the Palestinians to actually shoot and test their missiles, in addition to, of course, just trying to disarm and destabilize and cripple Hamas as much as possible, which is one, of course, goal. But one of the goals is the fact that given after the elections that this has now occurred where, you know, it doesn't seem to randomly just occur, didn't occur before the election, but that it also might be actually a test to see how other countries respond to Israel's actions. Like, what does Egypt do? Are they really militant? Do they seem eager to actually become involved? Or do you hear mostly rhetoric but no real signs of action of hostility? You know, what would, for example, the Obama administration do? What, you know, would this air defense system work so that you have a sense of how it may perform against Iran? So it would be, I think, less likely that Iran would actually attack Israel, because then it would be the provocation for them to actually attack their nuclear facilities. But Israel seems like it may be intending to do that without any Iranian provocation. And so for Iran, it would not be something where, despite their rhetoric, they, I think, would want to get involved in.
It seems that in the past, the Israeli army, commandos, etc., they've been seen almost as like the little engine who couldn't, because it's a small state, small country, but their army has been superb, and it seems like they're not afraid to do anything. And we saw that, you know, in the Olympics and the hostages, and what you just said about them possibly attacking Iran, the fact that they're ready no matter what. They're seeming like it's almost like we're here, take us on.
There seem to be differing views in Israel's government actually about the prospects of a successful strike against Iran. In particular, there's some variables or factors that are different between the scenario which involves Israel attacking Iran in the near future compared to when it actually took out Iraq's nuclear reactor under the 1982, 83, maybe. I'm a little rough on the date at this point on the year. But in that case, it was rather successful because there was actually an agent working for Israel that helped guide the planes in, and at a time when the technology wouldn't have been successful. They had much better intelligence than they seemed to have about Iran, just because it's unclear what Iran may actually be hiding or what the most important facilities are. There's some good intelligence about that, but there have also been revelations too as well that underscored the fact that not all was known in regard to that. And so that's rather important when it would come to targeting, and also the hardened nature of some of these potential targets. If you build these facilities underground, then they're just not in the wide open like Saddam Hussein's nuclear reactor was, his power plant, in that way. So some of the facilities are visible, some of them are above ground, but not all of them are. So that means that the type of armaments that you would need to strike them are not something that is necessarily easy. And so back in the Bush years, they were talking about nuclear tip bunker buster bombs, particularly with these types of scenarios in mind, which was a very provocative weapon and not necessarily one that Congress or other countries wanted to see in place. So if something's deep in the ground, you almost require that kind of armament, because normal cruise missiles or any kind of armaments dropped from, especially fighter jets, are not necessarily going to penetrate deep enough. And so that means that an Israeli strike is of some questionable actual nature if it fails to actually stop Iran and just makes relations in the region worse, and then actually allows Iran to show that Israel's behavior actually fits the Iranian, the mullah's rhetoric, that's so anti-Israeli, and then allows them to further, of course, rally other countries to Iran's views on this, because most countries do not abide very well to Iran's actual rhetoric. Syria is an ally of Iran, but they have their own problems right now. And even with that said, Syria's government's just very realist and pragmatic about it, because they're not very religious-based, even though that the leaders come from the Muslim tradition. They're much less motivated by religion than other leaders. That, combined with the civil war, means that it's pure power politics, the links between Iran and Syria in that regard. So given that, other countries that have typically feared Iran or distrusted it because of its Shia Muslim tradition and culture, it actually allows them to have much more common interest, especially some factions in places like Egypt or Iraq. And so that's potentially more dangerous for Israel if they actually strike Iran and it fails. But the idea that Iran would actually try to wipe Israel off the map is more than provocative. It's unrealistic for a few reasons. You can never say never, but right now they have no ability to do that. Their ability to attack Israel would be in the form mostly of either the type of terrorism that they've already been funding as a state sponsor of terrorism through Hamas, as particularly how Israel and often the United States sees it. But the only other way would be the missiles, the same kinds of missiles that Saddam Hussein had shot, but more modern, a bit more sophisticated, and they may be ineffective to the degree that this Israeli air defense works pretty well. So, of course, the big issue is if they had nuclear weapons, would they use it? And some people assume they would, but that would assume that the country is basically suicidal, because their chance of taking out Israel without some kind of retaliation from Israeli nuclear weapons is unrealistic. And so the type of logic that you would have to have would be much more of a suicidal nature. And we don't find countries that their leaders are typically suicidal. They may miscalculate, may even be destroyed, such as Hitler's Third Reich. But that wasn't the plan to be suicidal from the start. So there are scenarios where we would not want to see nuclear weapons in countries that often use radical rhetoric, or there are actually factions that might actually obtain these. Particularly Pakistan would be a much more risky state compared to Iran presently, but Iran's also unstable. So that scenario is interesting to the regard that it makes the region more unstable, but I don't think you'd rationally see Iran really want to attack Israel directly. It's more the case of Israel potentially attacking Iran, but that's itself a matter of big debate in Israeli military and political circles.
Of course, there's been caution among these other two countries, but do they play a role at all in this situation? And that's India and Turkey?
Turkey has had an interesting relationship with Israel, because it's actually had very close relations until the last couple years, and Turkey has itself a much more secular approach to politics and economics than a lot of the Middle East, because of Ataturk's government formed in the 1920s. But in the last few years, Turkey's become more democratic. Islamic parties have actually been the ruling party in Turkey. And a lot of people in the West feared that that would make Turkey much more similar to other Arab countries, more anti-Israeli. Other than the one incident about a year ago when some Turkish boats came to actually try to bring supplies, even possibly some weapons, to the Gaza Strip. Outside of that incident, the relations between Israel and Turkey are still not necessarily bad. A lot of other policy experts see that as a kind of cynical way to try to show Arab countries and other Muslim Islamic countries that Turkey really wasn't that different from them. So, but that in substance, Turkey has not necessarily become anti-Israeli, that they still work pretty closely with Israel.
Okay, Chuck, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today. And again, we've been visiting with Dr. Chuck Boehmer. He is with the Political Science Department here on campus, talking about the Middle East and what's going on in Israel right now. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.